The glow included the boy, the girl, this woman, and himself. Beyond that, there was no Mount Taesong, no Pyongyang, no dear leader. He tried to diffuse the pain in his chest across his body, the way his pain mentor Kim San had once taught him, to feel the flame not on the part but the entire, to visualize the flow of his blood spreading, diluting the hurt in his heart across the whole of him. And then he closed his eyes and imagined Sun Moon, the one that was always within him. She was a calm presence, open-armed, ready to save him at all times. She wasn't leaving him. She wasn't going anywhere. And here the sharp pain in his chest subsided, and Commander Ga understood that the Sun Moon inside him was the pain reserve that would allow him to survive the loss of the Sun Moon before him. He began to enjoy the song again, even as it grew increasingly sad. The sweet glow of the puppy's moon had given way to an unfamiliar rocket on an uncertain course. What had started as the children's song had become her song, and when the chords became disconnected, the notes wayward and alone, he understood that it was his. Finally, she stopped playing and leaned slowly forward until her forehead came to rest against the fine wood of an instrument she would never play again. "Come, children," Ga said. "It's time for bed." He ushered them to the bedroom and closed the door. Then he tended to Sun Moon, helping her to the balcony for some fresh air. The lights of the city below were glowing beyond their usual hour. She leaned against the rail, turning her back to him. It was quiet, and they could hear the children through the wall as they made rocket noises and gave the dog its launch instructions. "You okay?" he asked her.
"I just need a cigarette, that's all," she said.
"Because you don't have to go through with it. You can back out and nobody will ever know."
"Just light it for me," she said.
He cupped his hand and lit the cigarette, inhaling. "You're having second thoughts," he said. "That's natural. Soldiers have them before every mission. Your husband probably had them all the time." She glanced at him.
"My husband never had a second thought about anything."
When he extended the cigarette to her, she looked at the way he held it in his fingers and turned again to face the city lights.
"You smoke like a young bun now," she said. "I like the way you used to smoke, when you were still a boy from nowhere."
He reached to her, pulling her hair aside so he could see her face. "I'll always be a boy from nowhere," he told her. She shook her hair back in place, then reached for her cigarette, the V of her fingers indicating where it should be placed. He took her by the arm, turned her to him.
"You can't touch me," she said. "You know the rules."
She tried to pull loose, but he didn't let her.
"Rules?"
he asked.
"Come tomorrow. We'll have broken every rule there is." "Well, tomorrow's not here yet."
"It's on its way," he told her. 16 hours. That's how long the flight is from Texas. Tomorrow's in the air right now, circling the world to us. She took the cigarette.
"I know what you're after," she said. "I know what you want with your talk of tomorrow. But there'll be plenty of time, a forever's worth. Don't lose focus on what we have to do. So much has to go right before that plane takes off with us."
He held his grip on her arm. "What if something goes wrong? Have you thought of that? What if today is all there is?"
"Today, tomorrow," she said. "A day is nothing. A day is just a match you strike after the 10,000 matches before it have gone out."
He let go of her, and she turned to the rail, smoking now. Neighborhood by neighborhood, the lights of Pyongyang extinguished themselves. As the landscape blacked out, it became easier to see the headlights of a vehicle that was climbing the switchbacks of the mountain toward them.
"You want me?"
she eventually said.
You don't even know me.
He lit his own cigarette. The lights of the May Day Stadium had stayed on, along with the Central Cinema Studio north of town on the road to the airport. Other than that, the world had gone dark.
Your hand reaches for mine when you sleep, he said. I know that.
Sun Moon's cigarette burned red as she inhaled.
I know that you sleep curled up tight, he added. That whether you're a Yangban or not, you didn't grow up with a bed. You probably slept as a child on a small cot, and though you've never spoken of siblings, you probably reached out to touch the brother or sister asleep in the next one.
Sun Moon stared ahead, as if she hadn't heard him. In the silence, he could just make out the sound of the car below, but couldn't guess at what kind. He checked to see if Comrade Byuk had heard the car and was on his balcony, but the house next door was dark. Commander Ga went on.
I know you pretended to be asleep one morning, to give me more time to study you, to allow me to see the knot in your collarbone where someone had hurt you. You let me see the scars on your knees, scars that tell me you once knew real work. You wanted me to know the real you. I got those from dancing, she said. I'm not my movies, she snapped at him.
I've seen all your movies, he went on. And in all of them, your hair is the same, straight, covering your ears. And yet by pretending to be asleep, here he reached into her hair again, fingers finding her earlobe. You let me see where your ear had been notched. Did an MPSS agent catch you stealing from a market stall, or were you picked up for begging?
Enough, she said.
You'd tasted a flower before, hadn't you?
I said stop it.
He reached to the small of her back, pulling her till their bodies touched. He threw her cigarette over the balcony. Then he held his to her lips so she would understand that they would now share, and that each inhale would come from him. Their faces were close. She looked up into his eyes.
You don't know the first thing about me, she said. Now that my mother, now that she's gone, only one person knows who I really am, and it's not you.
I'm sorry about your husband. What happened to him, what I did. I had no choice,
you know that. Please, she said, I'm not talking about him. He didn't know himself, let alone me.
He placed a hand on her cheek and stared into her eyes.
Who then?
A black Mercedes pulled up, parking to the side of the house. Sun Moon glanced over at the driver, who stepped out to hold the door open for her. The driver no longer wore a bandage, but the bend in his nose would be there forever.
Our real problem has arrived, she said. The man who knows me, he wants me back.
She went into the house and retrieved the Chungi board.
Don't tell the children anything, she said.
And then Ga watched her climb into the car, her face impassive, as if such a car had come for her many times before. Slowly, the car backed out, and as its tires shifted from grass to gravel, he heard the grab of the road and knew that the ultimate had been taken from him. The orphan master had bent his fingers back and removed food from his very hand. And the other boys at Long Tomorrow's, as they died in turn, stole from him the notion that your shoulder should be turned against death, that death shouldn't be treated as just another latrine mate, or the annoying figure in the bunk above who whistled in his sleep. At first, the tunnels had given him nothing but terror, but after a while they began to take it away, until suddenly gone was his fear, and with it inclinations toward self-preservation. Kidnapping had reduced everything to either death or life. And the minds of Prison 33 had drained, like so many bags of blood, his ability to tell the difference. Perhaps only his mother had taken something grander by depositing him at Long Tomorrow's, but this was only speculation, because he'd never found the mark it had left, unless the mark was all of him. And yet, what had prepared him for this? For the dear leader tugging at the string that would finally unravel him. When the dear leader wanted you to lose more, he gave you more to lose. Sun Moon had told him that. And here it was. To what bunker would she be taken? With what light-hearted stories would she be regaled? What elixir would they sip while the dear leader readied himself for more serious amusement? Beside him, Goss suddenly noticed, were the children, barefoot on the wet grass. The dog was between them, a cape around its neck.
"Where did she go?"
the boy asked him. Ga turned to the two of them. "Has a car ever come for your mother at night?" he asked. The girl stared straight ahead at the dark road. He crouched down so he was at their level. "The time has come to tell you a serious story," he told them. He turned them back toward the light of their home. "You two climb into bed. I'll be there in a few minutes." Then he turned to face Comrade Byuk's house. He had to find a few answers first. Commander Ga entered through the side door. In Byuk's kitchen, he struck a match. The chopping table was clean, the washing tub empty and upturned for the night. He could still smell fermented beans. He moved to the dining room, which felt heavy and dark. With his thumbnail, he sparked another match, and here loomed old furniture, portraits on the wall, military regalia, and the family celadon, all things he hadn't noticed when they'd sat around the table and passed bowls of peaches. Sun Moon's home contained none of these things. On Byuk's wall hung a rack of long, thin smoking pipes that formed a history of the family's male ancestry. Ga had always thought it was random who lived and died, who was rich or poor. But it was clear these people's lineage went back to the Joseon court, that they were descended from ambassadors and scholars and people who'd fought the guerrilla war alongside Kim Il-sung. It wasn't luck that nobodies lived in army barracks while somebodies lived in homes on the tops of mountains. He heard a mechanical sound in the next room, and here he found Comrade Byuk's wife pumping the foot pedal of a sewing machine as she stitched a white dress by candlelight.
"Yoon has outgrown her dress," she said,
then inspected the seam she'd just sewn by passing the candle down its length.
"I suppose you're looking for my husband."
He noted her calm, the kind that came from befriending the unknown. "Is he here?"
"The Americans are coming tomorrow," she said. "All week he has been working late, preparing the final details of your plan to welcome them."
"It's the dear leader's plan," he said. "Did you hear a car arrive? It took Sun Moon away." Comrade Byuk's wife turned the dress inside out to inspect it again.
"Yoon's dress will now go to Jia," she said. "Jia's dress will soon fit Haegyo, and Haegyo's will wait for Soo-gi, who barely seems to grow."
She started working the pedal again.
"Soon, I'll be able to fold up another one of Suki's dresses and put it away. That's how I mark our life. When I'm old, it's what I hope to leave behind. A chain of unworn white dresses."
"Is Comrade Byuk with the dear leader? Do you know where they might be? I have a car. If I knew where she was, I could..."
"We don't tell each other anything," she said. "That's how we keep the family safe. That's how we protect one another."
She snipped a thread, then turned the dress under the needle.
"My husband says I shouldn't worry. That you made a promise to him that because of your word, none of us is in danger. Is this true? Did you give him your promise?"
"I did." She looked at him, nodded.
"Still, it's hard to know what the future holds. This machine was a bridal gift. I didn't imagine making this kind of garment back when I took my vows."
"When it's time, when that comes," he said, "does it matter what you're wearing?"
"I used to have my sewing machine in the window," she said, "so I could look out upon the river. When I was a girl, we used to catch turtles in the Taedong and release them with political slogans painted on their backs. We used to net fish and deliver them each evening to the war veterans. All the trees they now chop down? We planted them. We believed we were the luckiest people in the luckiest nation. Now all the turtles have been eaten, and in place of fish, there are only river eels. It has become an animal world. My girls will not go as animals.
Ga wanted to tell her that in Chongjin, there was no such thing as the good old days. Instead, he said, in America, the women have a kind of sewing in which a story is told. Different kinds of fabric are sewn together to say something about a person's life. Comrade Byuk's wife took her foot off the pedal.
And what story would that be?
She asked him.
The one about a man who comes to town to destroy everything you have? Where would I find the fabric to tell of how he kills your neighbor, takes his place, and gets your husband caught up in a game that will cost you everything?
It's late, Commander Ga told her. I apologize for bothering you. He turned to go, but at the door she stopped him.
Did Sun Moon take anything with her?
She asked. A janggi board. Comrade Byuk's wife nodded.
At night, she said, that's when the dear leader seeks inspiration.
Ga took a last look at the white fabric and thought of the girl who would wear it. What do you tell them? He asked. When you pull the dresses over their heads, do they know the truth, that you're practicing for the end? She left her eyes on him a moment.
I would never steal the future from them, she said. That's the last thing I want. When I was Yun's age, ice cream used to be free in Mansu Park on Sundays. I would go there with my parents. Now the ice cream van snatches children and sends them to 927 camps. Kids shouldn't have to contemplate that. To keep my girls away from the van, I boast that peaches are the best dessert, that we have the last canned peaches in Pyongyang, and that someday, when the Byuk family is at its absolute happiest, we'll have a feast of peaches that will taste better than all the ice cream in Korea.
Brando raised his head when Ga entered the bedroom. The dog no longer wore a cape. The boy and the girl were at the foot of the bed, worry on their faces. Ga sat on the floor beside them. Above, on the mantel, was the can of peaches he would take with him tomorrow. How in the world to tell them what he had to tell them? He decided to just take a breath and begin. Sometimes people hurt other people, he said. It's an unfortunate fact. The children stared at him. Some people hurt others for a living. No one takes pleasure from it. Well, most don't. The story I have to tell is about what happens when two of these people, these men who hurt others, meet.
Are you talking about Taekwondo?
The boy asked. Ga had to find a way to explain to them how it was he'd killed their father, ugly as that would be. If they left for America believing the lie that their father was still alive, that he loomed as large as the propaganda about him, then in the children's memory, that's who he would become. He'd turn to bronze and bear little resemblance to the real man. Without the truth, he'd be just another famous name, so much chiseling at the base of a statue. Here was the one chance to know who their father really was, a chance Ga never got himself. It was the same with their home. Without learning of the hidden DVDs, the contents of the laptop, the meaning of the blue flashes at night, their house on Mount Taesong would turn to watercolor in their memories, becoming as staged as a picture postcard. And if they didn't know his true role in their lives, he himself would become in their recollections nothing more than a guest who came to stay for some foggy reason, for some vague length of time. Yet he didn't want to hurt them, and he didn't want to go against Sun Moon's wishes. Most of all, he didn't want to put them in danger by changing how they might behave tomorrow. If only he could reveal the truth to them in the future, to somehow have a conversation with their older selves. What he needed was a bottle with a message inside that they'd only be able to decipher years from now. The girl spoke.
Did you find out about our mother?
She asked. Your mother is with the dear leader, he told them. I'm sure she's safe and will be home soon.
Maybe they're meeting about a movie,
the girl said. Maybe, Ga said.
I hope not,
the boy said.
If she makes a new movie, we'll have to go back to school. I want to go back to school,
the girl said.
I had perfect marks in social theory. Do you want to hear Kim Jong-il's speech from April 15th, Juche 86?
If your mother goes on location, Ga asked, who will watch you?
One of our father's flunkies,
the girl said.
No offense.
Your father, Ga said. That's the first I've heard you speak of him.
He's on a mission,
the girl said.
Those are secret,
the boy added.
He goes on lots.
After a silence, the girl spoke up.
You said you'd tell us a story.
Commander Ga took a breath. To understand the story I'm about to tell you, you need to know a few things. Have you heard of an incursion tunnel?
An incursion tunnel?
The girl asked, a look of distaste on her face. Ga said, what about uranium ore?
Tell us another dog story,
the boy said.
Yeah,
said the girl.
This time make him go to America, where he eats food out of a can. And bring back those scientists,
the boy added. Commander Ga thought about it a moment. He wondered if he couldn't tell a story that seemed natural enough to them now, but upon later consideration, might contain the kind of message he was looking for. A team of scientists was ordered to find two dogs, he began. One must be the smartest dog in North Korea, the other the bravest. These two dogs would be sent on a top-secret mission together. The scientists went to all the dog farms in the land, and then they inspected canine warrens in all the prisons and military bases. First, the dogs were asked to work an abacus with their paws. Then they had to fight a bear. When all the dogs had failed the tests, the scientists sat on the curb, heads in their hands, afraid to tell the ministers.
But they hadn't checked Brando,
the boy said. At the mention of his name, Brando twitched in his sleep, but did not wake. That's right, Commander Ga said. Just then, Brando happened to be walking down the street, with a chamber pot stuck on his head. Peals of laughter came from the boy, and even the girl showed a smile. Suddenly, Ga saw a better use for the story, one that would help them now rather than later. If in the story he could get the dog to America by stowing itself in a barrel being loaded onto an American plane, he could implant in the children basic instructions for the escape tomorrow. How to enter the barrels, how to be quiet, what kind of movement to expect, and how long they should wait before calling to be let out.
A chamber pot,
the boy said.
How did that happen?
How do you think? Ga answered.
Yuck,
the boy said. Poor Brando didn't know who had turned out the lights, Ga said. Everything echoed inside the pot. He wandered down the road, bumping into things, but the scientists thought he had come to take the tests. How brave of a dog to voluntarily face a bear, the scientists thought, and how smart to put on armor. Both the boy and the girl laughed large, natural laughs. Gone was the worry on their faces, and Ga decided that perhaps it was better for the story to have no purpose, that it be nothing other than the thing it was, spontaneous and original as it wandered toward its own conclusion. The scientists hugged each other in celebration, Ga continued. Then they radioed to Pyongyang, reporting that they'd found the most extraordinary dog in the world. When the American spy satellites intercepted this message, they... The boy was tugging Ga's sleeve. The boy was still laughing. There was a smile on his face, but he had turned serious somehow.
I want to tell you something,
the boy said. I'm listening, Ga said. But then the boy went silent and looked down.
Go on,
the girl said to her brother. When he wouldn't answer, she said to Ga,
"He wants to tell you his name. Our mother said it was okay, if that's what we wanted to do."
Ga looked at the boy. "Is that it? Is that what you want to tell me?" The boy nodded. "What about you?" Ga asked the girl. She too glanced down.
"I think so,"
she said. "There's no need," Ga said. "Names come and go. Names change. I don't even have one."
"Is that true?"
the girl asked. "I suppose I have a real one," Ga said. "But I don't know what it is. If my mother wrote it on me before she dropped me off at the orphanage, it faded away."
"Orphanage?"
the girl asked. "A name isn't a person," Ga said. "Don't ever remember someone by their name. To keep someone alive, you put them inside you. You put their face on your heart. Then no matter where you are, they're always with you because they're a part of you." He put his hands on their shoulders. "It's you that matter, not your names. It's the two of you I'll never forget."
"You talk like you're going somewhere,"
the girl said. "No," Ga said. "I'm staying right here." The boy finally lifted his eyes. He smiled. Ga asked, "Now, where were we?"
"The American spies,"
the boy said.
"Sad news, citizens, for our nation's oldest comrade has died at the age of 135. Have a safe journey to the afterlife, old friend, and remember fondly your days in the most contented, most long-lived nation on earth. Consider taking a moment today, citizens, to offer a respectful gesture for an older person in your housing block. Carry their ice blocks up the stairs, or surprise them with a bowl of chive blossom soup. Remember, not too spicy. And a warning, citizens, against touching any balloons that float across the DMZ. The Minister of Public Safety has determined that the gas which floats these balloons and the propaganda messages they carry is actually a deadly nerve agent meant to slay innocent civilians who encounter them. But there is good news, citizens. The city's notorious windshield wiper thief has been apprehended. The presence of all citizens is requested tomorrow morning in the soccer stadium. And more good news, shipments of sorghum have begun arriving from the countryside. See your ration stations for ample portions of this delicious starch. Not only does sorghum fortify the bowel, it also assists with male virility. Distillation of sorghum into Goryangju liquor is not allowed this year. Be prepared for random crockery inspections. Perhaps the best news of all, citizens, the next installment of this year's best North Korean story is here. As we near our tale's conclusion, already there are cries from the populace for more. But there will be no sequel, citizens. The conclusion of this story is one of eternal finality. Forget for a moment, citizens, that you're fabricating vinylon clothing or running an industrial lathe. Picture instead this scene. It is late. The moon's a sliver above, while beneath it Pyongyang slumbers. One car threads its beams through the city's towering structures, heading north, on the road to the airport. Looming ahead is the Central Cinema Studio, the largest film production facility on Earth. Here, hectares of Quonset huts link in a chain of unparalleled cinematic capacity. And it is here that the vehicle halted. From it emerged none other than Sun Moon, the woman for whom this facility exists. The corrugated bay doors parted for her, and a great light emanated from inside. Bathed in this warm glow, waiting to greet her, was none other than the most charismatic figure in all the world, the Reverend General Kim Jong-il. He threw his arms wide to her, and together they exchanged gestures of socialist support. Strong was the smell of Texan cooking. Great slabs of pork torso and the noodle called the macaroni. When the dear leader led her inside, Sun Moon discovered music, gymnastics, and synchronized forklifts. I thought the extravaganza to welcome the Americans would take place at the airport, she said. It will, the dear leader told her, but our preparations must occur indoors. He pointed to the sky, to safeguard against the spying eyes. The dear leader took our arms and squeezed them through the satin. You are healthy, yes? You are doing well? I want of nothing, dear leader, she said. Splendid, he responded. Now tell me of the American. How many bars of soap did it take to clean our dirty, dirty girl? Sun Moon started to speak. No, don't tell me, not yet, the dear leader interrupted. Save your opinions of her for later. First, I have something to show you, a little treat, if you will. The two began crossing the studio. Near the blast-proof film vaults, the Pochumbo Electronic Ensemble had set up and were playing their latest hit, Reunification Rainbow. To this music, a forklift ballet performed with pallets of food aid for America, their loads hoisted high as they circled, spun, and reversed in gay synchronicity with a lively tune. Most impressive, however, was an army of child gymnasts in colorful uniforms. Each limber tot held as his dance partner a 100-liter barrel. The children had these white plastic barrels spinning like tops, rotating as if on their own, and, surprise, the children were atop them, log-rolling them in unison toward the forklifts where they were to be stacked and loaded onto the American cargo plane. Tell us, citizens, have the hungry ever been fed with such precision and joy? When they neared, three Chosun Ots displayed on seamstresses' dummies, Sun Moon caught her breath at the sight of their stunning beauty. She stopped before them. The gift is too much, she said, admiring the trio of satin dresses, each flashing almost metallic, one white, one blue, one red. Oh, these, the dear leader said, these are not the treat. These you will wear tomorrow as you dress in the colors of the DPRK flag. The white one when we greet the Americans, the blue one while you perform your blues composition in honor of the girl rower's departure, and red as you escort the girl rower to her American fate. That is what will happen, right? Is that what you have chosen? I'm not to wear a dress of my own, she asked. I've already picked which one. I'm afraid it's been decided, he told her. So please, no sad faces. From his pocket, he withdrew an envelope and handed it to her. Inside, she discovered two tickets. What's this? She asked. It's part of the treat, he said. A sample of what's ahead for you. Examining them, she saw they were official tickets to the premiere of Comfort Woman. These are for next Saturday, she said. An opera had to be canceled, he said. But we must have priorities, yes? My movie, she said. In disbelief, she asked. My movie will finally be screened? All of Pyongyang will be in attendance, the dear leader assured her. If for some reason duty calls your husband on a mission, would you do me the honor? Would you join me in my box? Sun Moon gazed into the dear leader's eyes. She was almost without comprehension that someone so powerful and generous would assist a citizen as humble as herself. But with the dear leader, citizens, remember, everything is possible. Remember that his only desire is to protectively clasp each and every one of you in his everlasting embrace. Come, the dear leader said, there's more. Sun Moon could see that across the studio, a small orchestra was assembled. The two of them walked in that direction, passing through fields of props, all of which were familiar to her. A row of American jeeps and racks of GI uniforms pulled from dead imperialists during the war. And here was a scale model of Mount Paektu, birthplace of the glorious leader Kim Jong-il, born so close to the sun. Paekdusan, may your magisterial peaks ever extend to the heavens. As they strolled further, the dear leader said, "Now it's time to speak of your next film." "I have been practicing my lines," she told him. "For ultimate sacrifices?" he asked. "Throw that script away. I have changed my mind. A story of replacement husbands isn't for you. Come, come see your new projects." They came to three easels surrounded by musicians in tuxedos. And here in his tuxedo stood Tak Ho, the state movie producer. Because of his resonant tenor's voice, he'd performed the voiceovers on all her movies. Tak Ho removed the linen from the first easel, and here was the lobby card for Sun Moon's next movie. It depicted a ravishing Sun Moon, barely contained in her uniform, wrapped in the embrace of a naval officer, the two of them shrouded by a halo of torpedoes. "But surprise, citizens, the officer she embraces wears a South Korean uniform." "The Demon Fleet," Tak Ho announced, his voice robust and deep. The orchestra began playing a theme for the movie to be that was tense and brooding. "In a world of danger and intrigue," Tak Ho continued, "one woman would discover that a pure heart is the only weapon that can repel the imperialist menace. The sole survivor of an illegal South Korean assault on her submarine, Sun Moon is rescued by her sneak attacker's gunship. As a captive of the dashing ROK captain, she is pressed to reveal the defenses of the DPRK fleet. Slowly, however, she begins showing her handsome captor how he is actually the imprisoned one, jailed by the manipulations of the American regime. In the stunning climax, he turns his guns toward the real enemy." The dear leader smiled broadly. "The submarine we will use for the opening scenes is already moored in the Taedong," he said. "And as we speak, there is an entire naval detachment in the disputed waters searching for the appropriate ROK gunship to capture." The dear leader snapped his fingers and the sheet came off the second lobby card. Soaring violins began a refrain that was strong and inspiring. "The floating wall," Tak Ho began, but the dear leader cut him off. "This is a biopic about the first female Pubyok," the dear leader said, pointing at the beautiful, determined woman on the movie poster. He indicated the way her badge shone brightly and her eyes were fixed on a better horizon. "In this role, you will get results, cracking cases and proving that a woman can be as strong as any man." The dear leader turned to her for a reaction. Sun Moon pointed to the poster. "But her hair," she said, "it's so short." "Did I mention it's a true story?" he asked. "A woman really was hired at Division 42 not long ago." Sun Moon shook her head. "I cannot act with hair of this length," she said. "The character is Pubyok," the dear leader said, "so it must be short. You've never been one to shy from authenticity. You practically live your roles." He reached and touched her hair. "It's beautiful, but sacrifices must be made." The last movie poster remained veiled as Sun Moon's face saddened. Despite her best efforts, she began to weep. Arms crossed, she started walking away. Look, citizens, at how delicate are her sensibilities. The attentive citizen can see that no one else is pure enough to play these roles. That if anyone thieved Sun Moon from us, they will be stealing these powerful characters as well. Why, the movies themselves will be swiped from posterity. Kidnapped will be the very future of our nation's cinema, which belongs not only to our patriotic citizens, but to the entire world. The dear leader neared her. "Please say that these are tears of joy." Weeping, Sun Moon nodded. "What is it?" he asked. "Come, you can tell me." I weep only that my mother won't be able to make the premier of Comfort Woman, she said. Since retiring to Wonsan, she never writes, not once. I was just imagining her at the reception for Comfort Woman, seeing her own mother's story large across the screen.
Don't worry, I'll solve this. Your mother probably lacks only for typing paper, or perhaps the stamp deliveries to the East Coast have been delayed. I'll make a call tonight. Trust me, I can make anything happen. You'll have typed letters from your mother by sunset tomorrow.
Is it true? She asked. Can you really do anything?
With his thumbs, the dear leader wiped away her tears. It's hard to believe how far you've come, he said. Sometimes I forget that. Do you remember when I first laid eyes on you? He shook his head at the memory of some long ago moment. You weren't even named Sun Moon then. He reached into her hair and touched her ear. Remember that you have no secrets from me. That's what I'm here for. I'm the one you reveal yourself to. Just tell me what it is you need.
Please, she said, give me the joy of seeing my mother at the premiere.
Citizens, citizens. Ours is a culture that respects the elderly, that grants them their need of rest and solitude in the final years. After a life of labor, haven't they earned some remote quietude? Can't the greatest nation on earth spare a little silence for the aged? Certainly, we all wish our parents were spry forever, that they'd never leave our side. But Sun Moon, listen to the people cluck their tongues at you. See how selfish it is to burden your mother with an arduous journey, one on which she might perish simply to satisfy your own personal pleasures. But we throw up our hands. Who can deny Sun Moon? Ever the exception, so pure of emotion is she. She'll be sitting in the front row, the dear leader told her. I guarantee. Citizens, if the dear leader says it, that settles it. Nothing could prevent Sun Moon's mother from attending that movie premiere now. Only an utterly unforeseeable occurrence, a train mishap possibly, or regional flooding, could stand in the way of this joyous reunion. Nothing short of a diphtheria quarantine or a military sneak attack could keep Sun Moon's dreams from coming true. In a gesture of socialist support, the dear leader placed his hand upon her.
Haven't I followed all the rules? He asked. She was silent.
I have to have you back, he said to her. We must return to our arrangement.
It was an agreement, she said.
So it was, and haven't I lived up to my side? Haven't I followed your rules? He asked. That I never force you to do anything. Isn't that rule number one? Answer me. Have I ever gone against your will? Can you name one thing I've made you do?
She shook her head. That's right, he told her, his voice rising.
That's why you must choose to come back. You must choose right now. The time has come. His voice had turned sharp. Such was his paternal concern for her. He gave himself a moment of pause, and soon his charming smile returned. Yes, yes, you will have a new set of rules, I'm sure. There'll be whoppers, impossibly complicated rules. Already I can imagine the joy on your face when you spell them out to me. But I agree to them right now. I accept all your new rules in advance. He held his arms wide with possibility. Just come back. It will be like old times. We will play Iron Chef with the kitchen staff, and you will help me open my fan mail. We will ride my train to no place in particular and spend all night in the karaoke car. Inventing new kinds of sushi rolls. Don't you miss that? Remember playing Changi by the lake? We could have a tournament this weekend while your children zoom past my jet skis. Did you bring it?
It's in the car, she said. The dear leader smiled.
Where were we in our series? He asked. I can't remember our tally.
When we left off, I think I was down a few games.
You weren't letting me win, were you? He asked.
Assure yourself. I show no mercy, she said.
That's my Sun Moon.
He wiped the residue of her tears. Compose a song of departure for our night rower. Please sing her away from us. Wear that red Chosun art for me, won't you? Tell me you'll wear it. Just try it on. Try it on, and tomorrow we will send that American girl back to whatever forsaken place it was that bred her. Sun Moon cast her eyes downward. Slowly, she nodded. The dear leader, too, slowly nodded. Yes, he said softly. Then he lifted a finger, and who should briskly arrive astride a forklift but Conrad Byuk, sweat dripping from his brow. Do not gaze upon him, citizens. Avert your eyes from the puppetry of his traitorous smile. To guard the modesty of Sun Moon, the dear leader said, she will need some type of changing station at the airport. Comrade Byuk took a deep breath. Nothing but the finest, he said. The dear leader took her by the arm and turned her toward the lights and music. Come, he said. I have a last movie to show you. The American visit has got me thinking about cowboys and frontier justice. So I have composed a western. You will play the long-suffering wife of a Texas cattle driver who's being exploited by capitalist landowners. When a corrupt sheriff accuses the cattle driver of rustling, she stopped him. Promise me nothing bad will happen to him, Sun Moon said. Who, the cattle driver? No, my husband, or whoever he is, she said. He has a good heart. In this world, the dear leader told her, no one can make such a promise.
Commander Goss smoked on the balcony, eyes narrowed to the dark road below, searching for any sign of the car that might return Sun Moon to him. He heard the faraway bark of a dog in the zoo, and he recalled a dog on a beach long ago, standing sentinel at the waves for someone who would never return. There were people who came into your life and cost you everything. Comrade Byuk's wife was right about that. It had felt pretty shitty being one of those people. He had been the person who took. He'd been the one who was taken. And he'd been the one left behind. Next, he would find out what it was like to be all three at once. He extinguished his cigarette. There were stray celery seeds on the rail from the boy's bird snare. Ga rolled them under his finger as he gazed upon a city whose surface was black, but below was a labyrinth of brightly lit bunkers, one of which, he was certain, held Sun Moon. Who had thought up this place? Who had concocted its existence? How ugly and laughable was the idea of a quilt to Comrade Byuk's wife? Where was the pattern? With what fabric would someone sew the story of life in this place? If he had learned anything about the real Commander Ga by living in his clothes and sleeping in his bed, it was the fact that this place had made him. In North Korea, you weren't born. You were made. And the man that had done the making, he was working late tonight. The stray seeds on the balcony rail led the way to a mound of seeds. Ever so slowly, Ga extended his hand to them. Where was it, he wondered, that Comrade Byuk's wife got her calm in the face of it all? How was it she knew what had to be done? Suddenly a twig twitched, a stone fell, a thread tightened, and then a little noose cinched itself around Ga's finger. He searched the house, looking for information. For what purpose, of what kind, he didn't know. He went through Commander Ga's rice wine collection, laying hands on each bottle. He stood on a chair, and with the use of a candle studied a variety of pistols, haphazard in the upper cabinet. In the tunnel, he ran his eyes across all the DVDs, looking for one that might address his situation, but it didn't seem Americans made such movies. He studied the pictures on their covers, and read their descriptions. But where was the film that had no beginning, an unrelenting middle, and ended over and over? Reading English made his eyes hurt, and then it started him thinking in English, which forced him to think of tomorrow, and, for the first time in a long time, he was filled with great fear. There would be English in his head until he heard the voice of Sun Moon. When at last her car arrived, he was lying flat in the bed, letting the breathing of the children, unconscious, elemental, soothe him. He listened to her enter in the dark and in the kitchen ladle herself a glass of water. When she opened the door to the bedroom, he felt for the box of matches and drew one.
"Don't,"
she said. He feared that she had somehow been damaged or marked, that she was trying to hide something that had been inflicted upon her.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine,"
she said. He listened to her change into her bedclothes. Despite the darkness, he could visualize her, the way she removed garments and draped them across a chair back, how she balanced herself, hand against the wall, to step into the shift she would wear to sleep. He could sense her in the dark, touching the children's faces, making sure they were safe and dreaming deep. When she was under the covers, he lit the candle, and there she was, illuminated in golden light.
"Where did he take you?"
he asked.
"What did he do to you?"
He studied her face, looking for a sign of what she might have gone through.
"He didn't hurt me," she said. "He simply gave me a glimpse of the future."
Ga saw the three chozonots hanging red, white, and blue against the wall. "Is that part of it?" he asked.
"Those are the costumes I'm to wear tomorrow. Won't I look like one of those patriotic tour guides in the war museum?"
"You're not to wear your own dress, the silver one?" She shook her head. "So you'll leave here looking like the showgirl he wants you to be," he said. "I know that's not how you wanted to go, but the important thing is that you get out. You're not having second thoughts, are you?"
"You're still going, right?" "We're still going, right?"
she said. Then something caught her eye. She looked up to the empty mantle.
"Where are the peaches?"
He paused. "I threw the can off the balcony," he told her. "We won't need them anymore." She stared at him.
"What if someone finds them and eats them?"
she asked. "I cut open the lid first," he said, "so they'd all spill out." Sun Moon cocked her head.
"Are you lying to me?"
"Of course not."
"Can I still trust you?"
"I threw them away because we're not taking that path," he said. "We're choosing a different one. One that leads to a life like the one in the American movie." She rolled to her back and stared at the ceiling. "What about you?" he asked. "Why won't you tell me what he did to you?" She pulled the sheet higher and kept a hold of the fabric. "Did he put his hands on you?"
"There are things that happen in this world," she said. "And what is there to say about them?"
Ga waited for her to elaborate, but she didn't. After a while, she exhaled.
"The time has come for me to be intimate with you," she said. "There are many things that the dear leader knows about me. When we're safe on a plane, I'll tell you my story, if that's what you want. Tonight I'm going to tell you the things he doesn't know."
She craned her neck toward the candle and blew it out.
"The dear leader doesn't have a clue about how my husband and Commander Park plotted against him. The dear leader doesn't know that I hate his constant karaoke, that I've never sung a song for pleasure in my life. He has no idea that his wife used to send me notes. She put his seal on them to get me to open them, but I never did. He could never know how I turn my hearing off when he starts to confide his vile secrets to me. I would never tell him how much I hated you for making me eat a flower, how I loathed you for forcing me to break my vow never to eat as a starving person again."
Ga wanted to light the candle to see if she was angry or afraid.
"If I'd known..." "Don't interrupt me," she told him. "I won't be able to say these things if you stop me. He doesn't know my mother's prized possession was a steel zither. It had 17 strings, and you could see yourself in the black lacquer of its finish. the night before my younger sister died. My father filled the room with the steam of boiling herbs, while my mother flooded us with sanjo music. Fierce through the darkness, sweat coming off her, the metal strings flashing. It was a sound meant to challenge the light that come morning would take her little girl. The dear leader doesn't know that I reach for my sister at night. Not finding her every time wakes me. I would never tell him how that music is still stuck in my head. The dear leader knows my basic story, the facts of it. He knows my grandmother was taken to Japan to serve as a comfort woman. But he could never understand what she went through, why she came home having learned only songs of despair. Because she couldn't speak of those years, it was important that her daughters know these songs, and she had to convey them without the lyrics. After the war, just knowing Japanese could get you killed. She taught the musical notes, though, and how to transfer to the notes the feeling of the missing words. That's what Japan had taught her to do. To make the pluck of a string contain a missing thing. To store in a struck chord what had been swallowed by war. The dear leader doesn't understand that the skill he prizes me for is this. He doesn't know that when he first heard me singing, it was to my mother, locked in another train car, a song to keep her from despairing. There were hundreds of us on a relocation train to a redeemability camp, all with freshly bleeding ears. This was after my older sister was siphoned to Pyongyang for her beauty. This was after we'd agreed as a family that my father would try to smuggle out my little sister. This was after the attempt failed, after we'd lost her, after my father had been labeled a defector, and we'd become the family of a defector, my mother and I. It was a long journey, the train moving so slowly that crows landed on the roof of the boxcar, where they paced back and forth between the vent holes to stare down at us, like we were crickets they couldn't quite get. My mother was in another boxcar. Talking wasn't allowed, but singing was. I would sing Arirang to let her know I was okay. She would return the song to say she was still with me. Our train pulled onto a side track to let another pass. It turned out to be the dear leader's bulletproof train, which stopped so the two conductors could discuss the tracks ahead. Rumor spread through the boxcars. A hushed panic at what was about to befall us. People's voices rose, speculating on what was happening to those in other boxcars, whether people would be singled out. So I sang, loud as I could, hoping my mother might hear me above the sounds of anguish. Suddenly, the door to our train car opened, and the guards beat a man to his knees. When they told him to bow down, we all followed suit. And there, backlit by the bright light, appeared the dear leader. "Did I hear a songbird?" he asked. "Tell me, who among us is this forlorn bird?" No one spoke. "Who has taken our national melody and adorned it with such emotion?" the dear leader asked us, pacing through our kneeling ranks. "What person can so distill the human heart and pour it into the vessel of patriotic zeal? Please, someone, finish the song. How can it exist without an ending?" From my knees, tears falling, I started to sing. "Arirang, arirang, arario. I am crossing Arirang Hill. I believed you when you told me. We were going to Arirang Hill for a spring picnic. Arirang, your feet will fail you before you take 10 steps from me." The dear leader closed his eyes and smiled. I didn't know which was worse, to displease him or to please him. All I knew was that my mother would not survive without me. "Arirang, arirang, arario. Arirang all alone, with a bottle of rice wine hidden under my skirt. I looked for you, my love, in our secret spot.